Support for Florida Roundup comes from the Everglades Foundation, working to restore and protect Florida's $1 trillion asset that helps to bring clean water to Floridians. Learn more at evergladesfoundation.org.
This is the Florida Roundup. I'm Tom Hudson. Great to have you along this week. Today is Good Friday. It's also Passover. It's a time of community and reflection. So it's as good of a day as any to talk about what we think about each other. You know, it's become commonplace to describe America as divided, divisive, and dismissive of each other. A new international survey also finds we don't think very highly of the values of each other either. A majority of Americans think their fellow citizens' morality is bad. We're going to talk about this a little bit later on in the program. So what does it mean to be morally good? And do you believe your neighbor is morally good? Email us now with your thoughts, radio@thefloridaroundup.org. You know, we've seen how the culture war plays out here in Florida over public education, library books, diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts. So send us your thoughts, radio@thefloridaroundup.org. First, though, the latest front in Florida's so-called war on woke takes on the NFL. Attorney General James Uthmeyer says the league's Rooney Rule is against state law. The league's rule encourages NFL teams to interview non-white candidates for senior jobs, including head coaching positions.
The NFL's use of the Rooney Rule violates Florida law by requiring race-based considerations in hiring. Florida law is clear. Hiring decisions cannot be based on race.
Uthmeyer wrote a letter to NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell last week claiming the practice, quote, brazenly violates Florida law. But this week, after NFL owners held their annual meeting, the commissioner said there is no effort to change.
The Rooney Rule is not a hiring mandate. It's intended to try to help.
The son of the namesake of the rule, Art Rooney II of the Pittsburgh Steelers, echoed that description.
There was no action taken, just a statement from the Florida Attorney General. So, you know, probably have some conversations with the attorney general down there just to make sure he understands what exactly we do. It's not a hiring rule.
The attorney general did threaten civil action, though, if the NFL does not remove the Rooney Rule in Florida, at least. The AG here took aim at the league's employee training program as well. Uthmeyer wrote to the NFL, quote, stop discriminating based on race. Stop discriminating based on sex. Interview, hire, and train based on merit, end quote. Now, Florida has three NFL teams, Tampa, Jacksonville, and Miami. One of the three black head coaches in the league currently is here in Florida, Todd Bowles, with the Buccaneers. So what do you think about the Rooney Rule and how it is practiced on the sidelines in the front offices of your favorite teams? What do you think about the Florida Attorney General claiming the practice is discriminatory and against state law? 305-995-1800, statewide on this Friday, 305-995-1800. Send us a quick email, radio@thefloridaroundup.org. Tony Dungy is along with us, the first black head coach to win a Super Bowl, a Hall of Famer, a Tampa Bay area resident, and, of course, coach won the Super Bowl with the Indianapolis Colts. The coaching career, Tony, of course, began here in Florida, the head coaching career with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Tony, welcome to the program. Thanks for your time.
Hey, thank you very much. Good to be with you.
We really appreciate it. How do you describe the Rooney Rule in terms of whether or not it's a requirement or a recommendation?
Well, the Rooney Rule is an aid. It was supposed to be an aid in helping people find the best candidates. And I totally get what the Attorney General is saying. Hiring should be based on merit. And I think that's what this rule is all about. But it was to help discover people who might be merited to get jobs. So I think the spirit of the rule was excellent. I'm not a fan of how it's being implemented and how it's being used today, but I worked for Dan Rooney in Pittsburgh, and I know his heart, and I know what he wanted to see the rule do, and I think it's a good rule.
Yeah, I want to play you some sound from January of 2020. This was on the sidelines of the 49ers and Packers NFC Championship game right before the pandemic. So going back a few years here, Tony, but your criticism of the Rooney Rule is not just recent. This is something you were talking about back in January of 2020.
It really is not working like Dan Rooney envisioned it. Dan put this, helped get this rule started, and his idea was that an owner would have a a system, what he wanted in place. He would have an idea of the type of coach he'd want, and then he'd research that. I think people are using the interview to check the box, not really going after what really fits their situation.
That was you on NBC back in January of 2020, still criticizing the rule here today in terms of how it's being carried out. Why is that?
Well, Dan's process, and he followed that. He had a formula in mind. He hired three coaches in, I want to say, 40-some years, and they all turned out to be fantastic. But he had a formula. He wanted a defensive coach. He wanted a young coach. He wanted a teacher, an encourager. He laid all that out, and he hired Chuck Knoll in 1969. In 1992, he hired Bill Cowher, and then in 2006, he was looking for another coach, and so he laid those parameters out. But then he said, I want to specifically try to research some minority candidates because I don't know all of those candidates. So let me find and do some research on who fits this bill and interview a couple of minority candidates. He interviewed Mike Tomlin, who fit the bill perfectly. He ended up hiring Mike, and Mike coached 18 years there and took the Steelers to a couple of Super Bowls. That was how it was supposed to be in place. What has happened over the years is people have said, I just need to interview a minority candidate to satisfy the rule, and then I can go about looking for what I really want. And that is not the way Dan Rooney envisioned it. That's not how it should be done, and it's not going to be helpful to try to implement the rule that way.
What do you make of the case of Brian Flores, the black head coach who was fired by the Miami Dolphins, who has since sued several teams, including the league, claiming discrimination, and he says that the quote, the league is, quote, rife with racism. The NFL has denied wrongdoing. This is a case that is many years in the making and is still ongoing through the federal civil rights process here. What do you make of his complaint and his experience that led to this lawsuit?
Well, Brian Flores is a very good coach. He's in a position where he should be considered for some of these jobs. But I think with this lawsuit hanging over the heads, I think owners are very wary of saying, I don't know if I'm going to hire a coach who may be suing me and may be suing the NFL. So I think that adds a little something to it. I don't really think there's what you would say is absolute racism per se involved in the hiring process. I don't think there's owners out there who are saying, I really want to win a Super Bowl. I really want to have the best team that I can have for my fans, but I don't want to have a black coach or a minority coach. I don't think that happens. I think what does happen is you have a lot of people in the decision-making process as owners who really don't, it's not their number one business. They haven't made their fortune by having a football team. And they don't know necessarily what goes into being a good coach. They know what they've heard in the media. They know people who have been around their building, people who have been around them. So they may not have all the ammunition they need to do a great job in hiring. But I just don't think we're at the point anymore where people are saying, you know, I want to win, but I don't want to win with minorities.
Yeah. We're speaking with Tony Dungy, former NFL coach in Indianapolis and Tampa Bay, won a Super Bowl in Indianapolis, first black coach to do so, talking about the Rooney Rule, the effort in the NFL to diversify the talent pool for head coaches, business executives, and other top coaches, for instance. The attorney general here in Florida, James Uthmeyer, has claimed that the Rooney Rule violates state law. 305-995-1800 is the phone number if you want to join the conversation. Coach, you mentioned you knew Dan Rooney. You played in Pittsburgh. Dan Rooney was the president of the Pittsburgh Steelers in the 70s when you were on the sidelines there for a season. Art Rooney, has now operating the Steelers, has suggested a conversation with the attorney general here in Florida. What would you say to the Florida attorney general about this rule and about his complaint and his threat of civil action against the NFL?
I would say that, yes, if the rule was mandating a quota or mandating that you hire or do things a certain way, then that would be a problem. I could see that. But that's not what the rule is in place for. The rule is there to help people, supposedly help people in their search for the best candidates. And I think that's what we need to do. And so I think if he understands what the rule is really there for, now it's not being implemented the right way. And maybe he's saying the way it's being implemented is wrong. And we could have that discussion. But what the rule is there for is to help in the hiring process and help owners discover the best candidate.
Coach, he argues that the NFL requires teams to interview two minority candidates for head coach, general manager, and coordinating positions. Is that accurate in your understanding of the current Rooney Rule?
That's the way I've understood it. First, when it got put in, it was just a minority candidate. Right. Now I think it is two. But in any case, it's interviewing. Make sure you do research. That's all it's saying. Yeah. It's not saying that you have to hire, that we have to get this. But I can see where if you didn't know the process, you would say, okay, that could be a little discriminatory. But it's not saying you can't interview any other race of candidates, just that you have to interview two minority candidates. And it doesn't say you have to hire them. And as we can see from the last hiring cycle, there were zero African-American coaches hired. So it obviously isn't mandating anything.
Yeah. Have you been contacted at all as an ambassador of sorts to the Florida Attorney General, given your your senior role, not an official role in the NFL, but certainly a senior leader in this realm?
I have not been contacted by the legal department here in Florida. And,
What about on part of the NFL to be an ambassador back to?
I have been asked by the commissioner at times to talk with owners who were in the hiring process. I have reached out and other owners have reached out to me and asked about candidates. They've asked if I'm interested in some jobs, which I had to tell them no, but I have on an informal basis. Yes.
Yeah. So the Rooney Rule came about after you were fired in Florida, in Tampa, and Dennis Green was fired in Minnesota 23 years or so ago, despite winning seasons. Of course, you went on famously to lead the Colts to a Super Bowl. What was your experience in the hiring process and the role of race without the Rooney Rule?
Well, I don't think the Rooney Rule impacted my sense of how things were done. I know that, and this is 25 years ago,
right?
Ownership had a different view of coaches and what was successful. There was kind of a boilerplate, so to speak. This is what we're looking for. And in the 60s and 70s and early 80s, it was that rough, gruff, tough, older gentleman who commanded respect. And that's what a lot of coaches were looking for. And when I can, as a matter of fact, I can tell you a story. When I first started coaching with the Pittsburgh Steelers, another general manager from another organization told me, if you want to get ahead in this business, you need to shave your beard because you look like a player. You don't look like a coach. I went to Dan Rooney, who was our president and owner at the time. And I said, do you really want me to shave because I want to represent the team? And he said, no, absolutely not. Mm-hmm. We want you. We hired you. That's what we want. We don't care what other people think. Mm-hmm. And he encouraged me to be who I am. And that said a lot to me because I thought to myself, well, I can shave my beard, but I can't change who I am and the way I look.
Right.
But that was not what Dan Rooney was interested in. And that's not what I think owners should be interested in. But there was a time when that did play into things. I think we've gotten past that in a lot of ways. But I do think there are owners who don't know who the good candidates are. They go by the popular opinion. They go by the news media. They go by talk shows, all kinds of things. And Dan was just trying to say, do your research, find out all the people in this arena that fit your description of what you're looking for, and then pick the best person from that group.
You know, there are no shortage of statistics, of course, in modern football, but I can't imagine there's any statistics around the correlation or causation between a coach's facial hair and championships or winning percentage necessarily. So this intent of the Rooney Rule that you talk about, Coach, of a process put in place, right? There's a lot of pressure, of course, on teams to perform now, to win this year, and to, you know, put folks on the sidelines that are going to do that. You have argued in the past that you know, slow this process down
yes.
to help these owners, I think these are, I'm paraphrasing your words, to help
the owners. Yeah, no, you're exactly right.
To help the owners make the best decision, which argues around merit. Back to the Attorney General's argument here in Florida, though, is it seems like merely requiring interviews based upon race or gender, Attorney General Uthmeyer is arguing, affects the hiring decision and thus runs counter to Florida law.
Well, if you look at the results, it obviously hasn't affected the hiring at all. So we could look at results and argue that. But that was part of the whole process, too. And a reason for the rule was to slow things down. That if you have to do research and if you have to look for different candidates, you won't be able to just make snap decisions.
Yeah.
Now, one argument that I do have with the Rooney Rule, and one way that I think the Attorney General's point is true and valid, when I left the Indianapolis Colts, we had it set up in our set. We knew what was going to happen. Jim Caldwell was my assistant head coach. He was going to take over for me. It was set in stone. Well, because of the Rooney Rule, Jim Caldwell happened to be African-American, so we could just go ahead and go with the plan.
Hmm.
But if Jim Caldwell had been white, we would have had to interview a couple of minority candidates, even though we knew we were going to hire Jim Caldwell.
Right.
So that would have, you know, it would have been counterproductive.
Hmm.
And that is one of my arguments with it. Sometimes you do have that in place. You've got a longtime assistant. You know what's going to happen. You know who you're going to hire. Then following the rule to check the box really does a disservice to those you're hired. They're not really getting an opportunity. It's not a real interview.
Yeah.
And, you know, it slows things down.
Yeah. If you've built the succession plan already internally with your organization, what are alternatives to the Rooney Rule? Now that the league has been living with it for 20 some odd years, are there, it's expanded, it's changed, but are there alternatives to it?
Well, you would hope that we don't need the rule anymore. You would hope that people think, let me look at every possible niche and cranny that I can find because I want to get the best candidate. But that's not always the case. And this rule was there to be an aid to help people. It's not supposed to be a stumbling block.
Mm.
It's not supposed to put obstacles in your way. It's supposed to encourage you to do your research and look at every candidate. I can tell you as an head coach, hiring assistant coaches, I did that. And I scoured the landscape. I asked our scouts about college coaches. I knew a lot of NFL coaches and I knew who was good from coaching against them, but I had never coached in college. So I didn't know a lot of people in that landscape.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, tell me, who are the good teachers? Who are the good communicators? Who are the good instructors in college football? And they came to me with some names that I hadn't heard of. Lovie Smith, Mike Tomlin. They, even though they were African-American, I was African-American. I didn't know them. I didn't know Lovie Smith before I hired him. I did not know Mike Tomlin, but I did the research. And to me, that's what we want to encourage to happen.
Yeah.
We shouldn't need rules to do that. We should say, you know what, this is going to be better for you, for your team. If you really want to win, you owe it to your fans and your team and your fan base to investigate every possible person you can.
Yeah. Coach, we appreciate your time and your expertise in this. Thank you so much for creating the time
and
your schedule.
Thank you.
Appreciate
it. Good to be with you.
Tony Dungy, former head coach of the Tampa Bay Bucks, who then went on to lead the Indianapolis Colts to the Super Bowl, the only black head coach in the NFL to have a Super Bowl ring. He's a Hall of Famer as well. All right, coming up here on the Florida Roundup, we are going to talk about what we think about each other. A new international poll finds that the majority of Americans have a very low opinion of fellow citizens. So what do you think about your neighbors and why? 305-995-1800. 305-995-1800 on the Florida Roundup from your Florida Public Radio station.
Support for Florida Roundup comes from the Everglades Foundation, working to restore and protect Florida's $1 trillion asset that helps to bring clean water to Floridians. Learn more at evergladesfoundation.org.
This is the Florida Roundup. I'm Tom Hudson. We are happy to have you with us here. I want to clarify something I said just a couple of moments ago, that Tony Dungy is the first black head coach to win a Super Bowl in the NFL. Next week on our program, the rising price of life here in the Sunshine State, especially gas prices.
Well, I'm a courier, so gas is very important to me. I mean, I use my car to make money. With prices rising, that's meaning I'm making less money, which that's not good.
I can't even put 15 in the tank no more. I got to put at least 25 a day.
If the gas prices continue to increase, then there could potentially be an issue with that. So,
those drivers were filling up their pumps, filling up their tanks with pumps in Gainesville this week. The price at the pump is up about a dollar or so a gallon in the past month. It's an extra $15 or so every fill up. So what, maybe once a week? It's a little more than the price of a pub sub meal at Publix. $4 a gallon gasoline certainly gets a lot of attention, right? It is in our face every street corner with a gas station. You can see the price there. But, you know, it's not really gasoline that's been fueling the higher cost of living here in Florida. The price of eggs, for instance, has risen faster than gas prices over the past decade. So what prices are rising in your budget? That's what we want to hear from you for next week's program. And if you didn't have to pay these high prices for gas, for instance, what would you be spending that extra $15 a week on? Let us know by sending us a note to the email address radio@thefloridaroundup.org, radio@thefloridaroundup.org. That'll be next week. Now, here in South Florida, we live on a corner. We have gates across our driveway. And when we go away on a trip, we make sure that we give one of the remote controls to open the gates to one of our neighbors. Last weekend, I was out doing some yard work, and one neighbor came by and asked if we could watch their house in a few weeks when they are off on a trip. And, you know, when I was growing up, in our kitchen cabinet, right above the refrigerator, there were some hooks. And on those hooks were keys to the homes of three of our neighbors. And they had keys to our house as well. So I thought about this level of neighborhood trust when I read a recent survey from Pew Research. It found that Americans have the lowest opinion of their neighbors than people in more than two dozen countries.
In the United States, it was the only place in the 25 countries that we surveyed in where more adults describe the morality and ethics of others living in their country as bad than good.
Kirsten Lesage is with the Pew Research Center.
That's not to say that the U.S. is more moralistic or very judgmental around specific behaviors of their what people in America are doing.
So maybe not specific behaviors, but generally we've got a pretty poor opinion about the morality of fellow citizens. When asked about the morality of specific behaviors like gambling or extramarital affairs, for instance, we tend to agree with each other. But generally speaking, we do not have high opinions of the general values of one another. So why do we think so poorly of other Americans? What do you think about the morals of people in your community? Cross the street, cross town. 305-995-1800 is our phone number. 305-995-1800. And you know you're going to keep it civil with us. Charles in Sarasota sent us this email. He wrote, "I was born in Southeast Florida 74 years ago and have spent most of my life here. The problem I have with distrust of my neighbors is that most are recent arrivals. They see Florida in a different mindset from the ones who have been here a while. Many first encountered our state as tourists. They enjoyed the weather, but were oblivious to the realities of living in the tropics." Charles writes, "Days on the beach are much different than days without electricity or fresh water after a hurricane. They get a bad attitude and rush around in a frenzy, unlike the more laid-back lifestyle of my youth." He concludes, "People used to be much more friendly and supportive of their neighbors than they are now." Radio at the Florida Roundup.
It's a beautiful day in this neighborhood, a beautiful day for a neighbor. Would you be mine? Could you be mine?
Well, there's probably no better model of being a good neighbor and thinking highly of others, of course, than Fred Rogers. Before he was a fixture on public broadcast, Fred Rogers was a student at Rawlins College here in the Sunshine State, just outside of Orlando, where there's a statue of him today in his cardigan sweater and sneakers. Maxwell King wrote the book The Good Neighbor, The Life and Work of Fred Rogers. Maxwell, welcome to the program. Thanks for taking time out today.
Good to be with you, Tom.
What do you think Mr. Rogers would say about this survey finding the majority of Americans think their fellow citizens are morally bad?
First of all, I believe that he thought the single most important thing in the life of a child was strong community, certainly strong parents and strong neighbors. But he really believed that community, neighborliness, was critical for young children. So it's something that he emphasized on his program and emphasized all through his life. And he was worried about the fact the community seemed a little bit less coherent today than they did 50, 100 years ago. But I think Fred's perspective, and my perspective for that matter, is that these surveys really aren't right. And that's because the polls tend to be received by the people who are being polled in a political context, in an ideological context. So their answers are about how they think some of their neighbors present in terms of politics and ideology. If you look at things in terms of what really goes on in the neighborhood, what matters to people, it's things like what's the new store down the block? What can we do to help you? Who won the high school football game? And so I think those polls are misleading, because I do not think in day-to-day life people do mistrust their neighbors a lot more than they used to. It's just that today we seem to funnel everything through this political lens. And in terms of politics, there is a division.
Maxwell, you're spot on. The survey did find that politics plays a role, and it looked across politics, not just in the United States, but the more than two dozen countries where the folks were asking these questions. So what is the neighborly way to use politics, if there is a neighborly way to use politics to view morality of others?
Well, I think one thing that it's smart to do is don't go right to politics in the conversation, because the things that bind our lives together are the everyday things that we share, the ways in which we can help each other. So sure, we're going to talk about politics. And I think there are ways to talk about politics in which you emphasize listening and sort of playing back to the person you're talking to, even if you disagree with their politics, playing back to them what you're hearing from them. So the emphasis is less on telling people what to think than it is on listening and understanding them. And I know that's exactly the way Fred would have done it.
Yeah. I want to correct myself. I misidentified the college in Florida, Rollins College, outside of Orlando in Winter Park. My apologies to the good people of Rollins College and the alumni.
Hey, Tom, you also took away Mike Tomlin's Super Bowl.
I know, and I corrected that one as well. I'm 0 for 2 today. I know. Well, it's just yet more evidence on this Friday that I am entirely human, and none of this is artificial intelligence. Very little of it's intelligence in some cases, Maxwell. Let's be honest with each other.
Being human is part of what makes you good at your job.
Well, I don't know about that. I'll let others decide that. Heidi has been listening in to us, Maxwell, in Fort Myers. Heidi, thanks for your patience. You're on the radio. Go ahead.
Well, one of the reasons that I think people are pretty disenchanted with their neighbors is because of HOAs, and because of they've all created like their own special Facebook group, and they sit in their home and they make these wild posts, and then they argue with people online, and they think they can say anything they want. And it's just amazing how much hate comes out of those.
Yeah, in your HOAs, homeowner associations, that's not... how to describe this? It's not unique to Florida, but there's certainly lots of them in Florida. And boy, yeah, there could be some high stakes drama with HOA board meetings and other conversations, Heidi. How do you offer up maybe some solutions for folks beyond just putting the screen down and going out onto the front porch as opposed to yelling at your smartphone?
Actually, getting out and meeting your neighbors. You know, we have an HOA that is just absolutely militant about putting out your garbage, if you can believe that. And we moved here from Washington State and no HOA, and I put my garbage cans out one time, well, all the time now, the day before, because I'm busy, and they come first thing in the morning, and they said, you're going to get fined. And I said, go ahead and try it. You know, I'm going to do it when it's my convenience.
Yeah.
And I went around, and the neighbors, they understand now, and they aren't.
They're not taking to social media to complain about Heidi and her garbage can that's out there all night before the trash collectors come by in Fort Myers. Heidi, thank you for sharing your perspective. Maxwell, it's interesting there, right? The impact of social media is clear and you know, couldn't be more obvious to us in terms of the anonymity as well as the ability to say many, many things that we would not say to the face of our neighbors. So how do we improve our view of one another?
Well, I think, first of all, she makes such an important point about the things that are dividing us. It's not just the political differences, but the social media and the communications technology itself is designed to drive controversy. It's designed to be, to grab your attention and therefore to heighten divisions. And so I think everybody's gonna use communications technology in a variety of different ways. And it's not a strategy to try to just avoid it. But I think if we can check ourselves and spend less time doing our communication on social media and try to do it as often as possible face-to-face or even on the telephone, because it's that human interaction. Yep. I think we all know if you want to send a sharp message to somebody, the best thing in the world is talk to them about it. Don't shoot off an email or a text or something like that. It's the face-to-face or interpersonal interactions that actually bring us together.
What do you think Mr. Rogers would make of social media today in 2026?
I think he would be innovating like crazy. Remember, he started out in the early 1950s. Mm-hmm. He was the first person in the world to use television as an educational tool. He was an innovator using the cutting edge technology of his day, television. So he would be, as he was with email early on before he died, he would be looking at today's technology and figuring out what are the ways to use it to help children and to bring families, neighbors, communities together.
Well, great lessons to still continue to learn from Fred Rogers. And Maxwell King wrote the book, The Good Neighbor, The Life and Work of Fred Rogers. Maxwell, thank you so much for sharing your time with us. We hope you have a terrific weekend.
Thank you, Tom.
We'll give the last word to Brian from Tampa, who emailed us. There are many divisions among neighbors because people cannot or will not even set aside the time and thinking effort to contemplate the concept that one person does not want to be treated the same as another person wants to be treated. The inbox is open for your thoughts about how we treat each other, how we think about the morality and the values of one another. Radio at thefloridaroundup.org. Radio at thefloridaroundup.org. I'm Tom Hudson, and you're listening to the Florida Roundup from your Florida Public Radio station. So I was out on a walk in my neighborhood this week, and I heard this familiar sound. Not a buzz, exactly, right? It's not a growl or a grumble. It's kind of that low-frequency whir, droning on, carrying across the yards and the driveways. And on my walk, it's getting a little bit louder. There's nothing to say about this exhaust that's coming from these gas-powered wind machines. The leaf blowers were out in the neighborhood during my walk. Now, there's a handful of Florida cities that have banned gas leaf blowers, but a new law bans those bans. Let the gas-powered blowers blow. Douglas Soule covers state government for our partner WSF in the Your Florida Reporting Project. Douglas is with us from Tallahassee. Douglas, so what led to this ban of bans?
Yeah, so as you identified, there have been a lot of conversations about the exhaust and fumes from gasoline-powered lawn equipment, particularly with leaf blowers. Another loud concern is how loud these gas-powered lawn equipment devices can be, noticeably louder than many of the electric kinds. As a result, some communities have tried to ban the gas-powered ones, and some have. The legislation rolls back those bans and blocks future ones.
When does it take effect?
It takes effect on July 1st, and so from that point on, residents can use a full buffet of options from gas-powered to electric.
Hmm. And what type of gear can be used? What type of equipment? It's more than just leaf blowers that are affected by this, right?
Yeah, I mean, any kind of gas-powered lawn equipment wouldn't be able to be banned in the future. Now, my understanding from a Miami Herald article is that currently no local municipality bans, for example, gas-powered lawn mowers, but certainly many communities have banned things like gas-powered leaf blowers. Mm-hmm. as well as gas-powered chainsaws. Now, moving forward, residents can use whatever they want.
Yeah. So the local bands have cited pollution as a main concern, even perhaps more so than the noise. How does the governor and the supporters address the exhaust issue, or do they?
Interesting question. The gas emissions can be harmful to the environment and health. The research on that is clear, but DeSantis doesn't really focus on that. He frames this as a government overreach issue. He thinks local governments went too far with the bans. He says it's a person's decision, not a government's. He even says he prefers gas-powered ones, though as governor with his own governor's mansion, I'm not sure the last time he would have had to use one.
Not doing some yard maintenance there in the mansion. So this ban on bans is really, Douglas, right, just the latest preemption law to come out of Tallahassee, banning local governments from regulating stuff through the years, like plastic grocery sacks, rent control, and even safety standards when working outside in the heat. All of those regulations have been banned by the state government. So any idea what could be next?
It's hard to predict exactly what's going to happen in future legislative sessions. We have a new leadership coming in after this year, but there's definitely a trend here, as you, Tom, identified. There's actually, though, something we can predict because it passed this past session. There is a bill that the legislature approved banning local governments from passing net zero emissions policies to reduce greenhouse gases. Emissions. That's not been sent to DeSantis's desk yet, but I have to imagine he will sign that as he also signed the gas-powered ban on bans.
The ban on bans. Yeah, the preemption is the political science word there. Douglas Soll covers state government for our partner WUSF and the Your Florida Reporting Project. Douglas, thank you so much for spending your time once again with us.
No, it's always good to be on.
Love to hear about your experience with gas-powered lawn equipment. Yes, the noise issue, the exhaust issue. What do you make of this? Are there rules and limitations perhaps that your community has on the time of day that equipment can be used? Radio at thefloridaroundup.org is our inbox. Radio at thefloridaroundup.org. Always love to hear from you there. All right, stick around. We got plenty more to talk about, including returning to the moon orbit, beginning here in Florida. You're listening to the Florida Roundup from your Florida Public Radio station.
Support for Florida Roundup comes from the Everglades Foundation, working to restore and protect Florida's $1 trillion asset that helps to bring clean water to Floridians. Learn more at evergladesfoundation.org.
This is the Florida Roundup. I'm Tom Hudson. It is great to have you along. This week, the Supreme Court heard arguments over President Donald Trump's effort to do away with birthright citizenship. Among the dozens of executive orders the president signed on his first day in office was a ban on granting U.S. citizenship to everyone born in America.
On January 2025, when the current administration took office, that executive order was one of those that make us feel like terrified.
This is Michelle. Now, that's not her real name. We have spoken with her a couple of times over the past year and a half as she and her husband navigate the shifting immigration system. They're from Venezuela and came to the U.S. more than a decade ago. They had a daughter in Florida.
We were already married. We waited until I was 36 to have our daughter. So it wasn't something that suddenly happened. No, we plan, we wait, we work hard in our stability, our financial situation. When everything was stable, we decide to have our child.
That was 8 years ago. Today, their daughter is in second grade and is an American citizen since she was born in the United States. Michelle and her husband, Sean, came to America legally, first claiming asylum, then protected status, and more recently, Michelle was granted a H-1B visa.
It's been a long journey, but we had been always doing things within the law. So in January 2025, things were really, you know, shocked for us because we were trying to have another child.
Florida has a lot at stake with the Supreme Court's decision on President Trump's effort to do away with birthright citizenship. Almost 1 million people from a foreign country have moved to Florida in the past decade. Census Bureau data show 9 out of 10 people moving to Florida last year came from overseas. Today, about 1 in every 5 Floridians were born in another country, like Michelle and Sean. Now, some have become citizens, like Michelle and Sean want to. Michelle told me they have been allowed to apply for permanent residency, a green card. The next step would be to become citizens. Michelle says they're racing against the clock, but not for their American immigration journey, but for their family planning.
I'm talking about biological clock. I'm 44. So, of course, I had visited my doctors, everything. They said, you're not old, you're not old woman, you still can, don't worry. But I don't know how long I can wait. Maybe in June we have good news. And we don't have to wait to become a resident. We don't have to wait until the ban pass. We don't have it's so many things. I mean, imagine all this stress. Because usually women, you know, we want to have a baby. And for some reason, it's not possible because the age or because the so many things, right? The stress is a key factor. So imagine the normal stress of a woman. But now this super stress on top. Playing against the thing, but you know, if God wanted, you know, if it's something that is going to be for good, God is going to allow us to do it.
She and Sean speak often about their faith when talking about their immigration efforts, and it's a faith Michelle says she now hears from their daughter.
When that little girl prays for a sister or brother, even she says in her prayers, it doesn't matter if it's a boy or a girl. I just want someone to play. Yeah, it's heartbreaking, but you know, we cannot control that.
For now, Michelle says they're working toward their green card and waiting for the Supreme Court.
We are stressed and worried about an unborn child legal status. Yeah. It's exactly like that.
Hundreds of thousands of Haitians living in the U.S., many here in Florida, are waiting for another Supreme Court decision. The justices have agreed to hear arguments late this month on the Trump administration's decision to cancel temporary protected status for Haitians. Tamara LaBruce is the executive director of the San La Haitian Neighborhood Center in Miami.
The reality is that the people most affected by this decision are families, workers, parents, and children who have spent years contributing to their communities while living with uncertainty about their future.
According to the State Department, Haiti is under a level 4 do not travel advisory due to kidnapping, terrorist activity, civil unrest, and more. Florida has the highest concentration of Haitian immigrants in the United States. This situation is similar over the protected status for Venezuelans and how that played out last fall, but the Supreme Court allowed changes to protections for some migrants, even as the overall legal battle continued. I'm Tom Hudson. You're listening to the Florida Roundup from your Florida Public Radio station. So where were you on Wednesday at 6:35 in the evening? I bet you remember if you watched the first American astronauts blast off from Florida for a return trip to orbit the moon, the first such trip in more than 50 years. If you've been around long enough, maybe you remember other trips to the moon. 1969, July, for instance, maybe September of 1970, or 1972, the last time Americans went toward the moon. Well, let us know what you remember about those previous moonshots. Send us an email, radio@thefloridaroundup.org. We'd love to hear your history, radio@thefloridaroundup.org. Here's Brendan Byrne from our partner, Central Florida Public Media.
Booster ignition and lift off. The crew of Artemis II now bound for the moon. Humanity's next great voyage begins.
NASA's massive SLS rocket roared to life at 6:35, its twin solid rocket boosters and four engines cracking the air, lifting the Orion capsule and four astronauts into space under a smoky trail into a clear blue Florida sky. It was a smooth countdown, though teams did investigate a couple of problems before the launch. Those problems were not the same as what plagued the rocket in earlier tests, like leaking hydrogen fuel and communications problems. Before liftoff, Launch Director Charlie Blackwell Thompson gave the final go for launch.
Reed, Victor, Christina, and Jeremy, on this historic mission, you take with you the heart of this Artemis team the daring spirit of the American people and our partners across the globe, and the hopes and dreams of a new generation. Good luck. Godspeed, Artemis II. Let's go.
And they did just that. So far, NASA Administrator Jared Isaacman is considering the mission a success.
NASA astronauts Commander Reid Wiseman, Pilot Victor Glover, Mission Specialist Christina Koch, and Canadian Space Agency Mission Specialist Jeremy Hansen are safe, they're secure, and they're in great spirits. We will continue to monitor their health and the status as we move into the next phase of the Artemis II mission.
The mission is a critical test of the Orion spacecraft, named Integrity, flying with a crew of four for the first time ever. So far, mission pilot Victor Glover took manual control of the spacecraft while in Earth orbit, testing its maneuverability for future dockings with a lunar lander while in orbit. They want to see if it flies the way it was designed, and
we also want to give qualitative and quantitative feedback to the ground team, so letting them know what it feels like now that we can hear and feel the thrusters, and to just understand the human experience.
These tests are happening while the spacecraft is circling the Earth. The mission is the start of a new chapter of lunar exploration. Just last week, Isaacman drastically changed the Artemis program. He scrapped plans for a lunar orbital station, instead calling for a science base on the surface of the moon. And he wants to fly Artemis missions more frequently. The last one was in 2022. For Republican Congressman and Chairman of the Space and Aeronautics Subcommittee, Mike Haradopoulos, success is not only good for NASA, but for Florida's Space Coast.
This is a big test for the USA, and I think that if we can find success, like I highly anticipate, we're going to see this space industry grow more. And it's not just, again, a national exploration. It is a growing part of our economy.
For Isaacman, he hopes the launch of Artemis II goes beyond Florida's space coast and inspires people across the country.
I think after Artemis II, you're going to have more kids that are going to dress up as astronauts for Halloween. We want to inspire and create interest in the next generation to grow up and contribute to this endeavor.
And Isaacman might be one step closer to that wish. Over 14 million people tuned into NASA's live broadcast on YouTube to watch this new chapter of space exploration unfold here on Florida's Space Coast. I'm Brendan Byrne at the Kennedy Space Center.
This mission is historic in so many ways, including
the one place that we can go during the mission where we can actually feel like we're alone for a moment.
This is Mission Specialist Jeremy Hansen in a video from the Canadian Space Agency. Among the new equipment on the Orion space capsule.
So here you can see the toilet, and there's enough room for you to float in here and close the door.
Now it looks similar to an airplane bathroom, maybe a little bit smaller. There's no sink, and it didn't look like there was a mirror, at least in the mock-up practice toilet on the ground. The number twos are collected on board using airflow from the toilet. It will be brought back to Earth. There are handles and foot restraints to hold astronauts in place while they're doing their business. As for the number ones?
As far as the urine goes, it gets collected, and a few times a day we vent that urine to space.
Now in space lingo, it's not a toilet, it's the Universal Waste Management System. And there was a problem early on. A fault light was blinking. NASA called it a controller issue, and it was fixed. And by the way, it's so noisy inside that the astronauts have to wear hearing protection. So, no yelling about taking too long in the loo. That's our program for today. It is produced by WLRN Public Media in Miami and WUSF in Tampa. Our crew that gets us up and off the ground and on the air each week includes Bridget O'Brien and Denise Royal. They are our producers. WLRN's Vice President of Radio is Peter Mertz. The program's technical director is MJ Smith. We get engineering help each and every week. Clearance from the Tower from Doug Peterson, Harvey Broussard, and Ernesto J. Our theme music is provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at AaronLibos.com. Thanks for calling, emailing, listening, and above all, supporting public radio in your slice of the Sunshine State. I'm Tom Hudson. Have a terrific weekend.
Support for Florida Roundup comes from the Everglades Foundation, working to restore and protect Florida's $1 trillion asset that helps to bring clean water to Floridians. Learn more at EvergladesFoundation.org.